Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording November 5th, 2020, we're talking to our fellow and the Defense and Security Fellow at GlobeSec, Roger Hilton, about the recent Bratislava Forum and some of the security and defense implications identified in GlobeSec's recent Megatrends report. Roger, welcome back to Defense Deconstructed.
Dave, thanks for having me. It's always great to be here.
So you are joining us from Vienna, a particularly interesting place to be right now, not just because of the recent events this week, which you can maybe touch on a bit and just give a sense of how things are unfolding from your vantage point, the recent terror attack. But the reason we wanted to sit down and have the chat is that your organization was involved in the recent Bratislava Forum, which is a particularly unique event given everything that's going on and the health concerns, which is one of the international forums for defense and security. Get us rolling by talking a little bit about what happened with there, how you put it together in a unique fashion, and what some of the highlights from your perspective are for a Canadian audience interested in defense.
Yeah, so I mean, just to begin with, obviously, we're reporting this on a Thursday. You know, it was just a shocking terrorist attack on Monday. And I think what stood out for me the most, it was this type of event just doesn't happen in Vienna. It shook the locals to the bone. Obviously, Vienna has a relatively small Jewish community, which is where the attacks allegedly started at a synagogue. But I mean, it was nothing but sheer pandemonium all of Monday evening. I think the government was more comfortable in their decision-making as they came on. But the most important thing to really stress to everybody is that the one major positive to come away with this was in a country that obviously has a very checkered past when it comes to migration for obvious reasons. The heroes of the day were two Turkish Austrians who saved a police officer and saved an elderly lady. And what was so reassuring about the government's response was them saying to the public that, you know, it was people of ethnic backgrounds who really contributed to the safety of our society, and it's something that we should be celebrating, not targeting. So again, I really hope the city gets back on its feet, and I have no doubt it will. When it comes to the 2020 Bratislava Forum, Dave, I mean, you couldn't be more accurate about it. Organizing a conference in a global pandemic doesn't seem the typical run-of-the-mill type of activities. But just to give the audience a bit of an overview, the organization was working very closely with the health ministry and other departments to ensure complete and unprecedented health safe protocols. The first thing to start with is that everybody, whether you are a worker, a speaker, or a participant, everybody was tested with one of these rapid antigen tests. So the whole process was about building a light bubble where you weren't allowed into the venue until you tested negative. The next thing was obviously face masks were obligatory. And after you received your negative COVID test, you walk to the turnstile, and the turnstile will not move until your facial recognition takes your temperature and sees a mask as well. So, I mean, this was already one safeguard that even despite having the test, there was another fall safe that you had to do, which was, it was sort of out of a movie, half apocalyptic, half futuristic to do it. And once getting in there, there was the typical social distancing. There was mask compulsory throughout the event, buffet lunch style. And I can report with a lot of satisfaction that of the two major conferences we had with the forum and the TATRA summit, which we did immediately afterwards, we screened out 30 COVID positive cases, which could have potentially infected the audience, speakers, participants, and workers. We screened out those. And then most importantly, the people, all of the participants and everybody who returned back to their homelands, nobody tested positive immediately in the afterwards. So while we were in this hybrid format of having a portion of the participants there in person and the other half virtually, it does show that with strict protocols, it is possible to have in-person events during the pandemic. In terms of the subject matter for Canada, there's no doubt that the highlight of it was having Minister Harjit Sajjan speak on a panel, the main NATO panel with EFP defense ministers from Latvia and GlobeSec. This was especially important for Canada for a lot of reasons, but his blunt assessment of China's use of hostage diplomacy, I think, was well received by the other allied defense ministers, where things like global trade, the ongoing situation between Turkey and Greece was brought up, and more importantly, that, you know, investment in collective security, collective defense, it's not a controversial topic anymore. We have to continue to do it, not just for traditional hard security topics, but also for things like a pandemic, which I think we'll get to now.
Okay, so with the pandemic, I think is a good point of departure. You were working on some other material for your organization that dealt with some of the other trends, including some of the health issues. And as we were chatting, two of us, before we started recording, you're seeing increasingly the military forces being used around the world in a bunch of very unconventional ways in support of the current health measures. So I guess using that as the jumping off point, what are you were looking at some different health trends and what could be driving some of those issues to basically remain on the defense radar in the future for a number of different reasons. So what were you highlighting in some of the work that you were doing?
Yeah, I have to be completely honest with everybody. I mean, coming from the security background, focusing on, you know, organizations like NATO or DND, I didn't really have a lot of formation when it came to public health security. But what really stood out for me was, I mean, this is a scary topic that's interconnected with a lot of different issues. It doesn't discriminate whether you're a developed or developing country, as this pandemic has shown. And most importantly, that the countermeasures and what we need to protect it, the military is only one aspect of it, where we'll get to it a little bit later about building resiliency. And there's a responsibility of the individual, the state, organizations, and societies to all come together to strengthen the chance of success and likelihood in the future. Just a quick, you know, just a couple of quick stats for everybody out there. Nobody should have been surprised that COVID happened. There has been, you know, a litany of reports coming out as early as 2018 from the National Biodefense Strategy of the United States saying it's only a matter of time before there's a zoonotic disease that's going to be circulating everywhere. So it's a bit frustrating having done all this research, knowing that we knew this was on its way and we didn't do anything. So again, some of the other major takeaways for me from the report, Dave, where climate change is going to be impacting so many people, you know, both in the developing and developed world. Communicable diseases, rising waters, food security, migration, all of this is all packaged into it. And we're really just at the beginning of this, which is, you know, my personal opinion. Migration and also the urbanization, where we're starting to enter this phase of an unhealthy relationship and ecosystem between humans and animals, where we're not showing enough respect to them. And over the course of the last three decades, 70% of the new transmissible diseases came with the spillover effect. So like I said, I think it's in everybody's interest, both Canada, the West, and developing countries to sort of get to take this issue as seriously as they would as an impending invasion.
So to move from there, what are some of the implications that you've identified for defense forces strictly? So I think in Canada, we've seen a couple of different things. In having a conversation with our chief of defense staff in a different podcast, mentioning that, you know, he's kind of the first head of our military in basically a century that had to really worry significantly about the spread of communicable diseases in a major way of his own forces. But beyond that, he ended up running long-term care facilities in Canada, a completely unprecedented situation. So if you're looking beyond just the examples that we've seen, like what are the implications of all of that and the different factors that are potentially leading to an increased prevalence of highly transmissible diseases, potential additional pandemics? What does that mean for all the defense and security actors around the world?
Well, I think, again, when the peace dividend of the Cold War with the reduction of forces, what really, again, is something that has stood out for me is that the advantages of having a relatively large and ready military are so important for all of the various reasons. We spoke about, you know, before going on air about the people who are working in the long care homes or setting up field hospitals in Europe, you know, disinfecting public areas or acting as psychologists. These people, they are taken away from readiness from other areas of the military. So I think you're seeing a new type of flexibility or adaptability that armed forces are going to have to adapt into the future. This is going to impact doctrine making, policy making. It's also going to set higher targets for recruitment. I mean, we need more people in the military to do a variety of things, whether it's engineering, traditional defense, or some of the other issues I managed. When it comes to sort of the actual role of military in the pandemic, yeah, it's a bit of a complicated issue. As I said, a lot of the issues, I think they're going to be playing a supporting role. You know, when it comes to NATO, for instance, one of the big issues on the African continent that they're looking for is better early warning system to see if that droughts are on the way, if there are tsunamis that are coming. And, you know, NATO, who has much more advanced ISR, you know, can provide them and get decision-making. It can improve the decision-making of these leaders and also allow potentially developing nations to call in international assistance earlier. They can scale up operations quicker. And also the military, as we said, they play a huge role in crisis management and crisis stabilization. So on the surface, I see that as one of the immediate impacts of the military and global health security.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries. Any sense coming out of both the report you did, but any discussion that came out of the forum itself about how that's actually manifest adapting itself for organizations like NATO. So NATO's got all kinds of different things on its plate. I know it's, at least sitting here in Ottawa, it's virtually impossible to have a conversation with anyone that doesn't start with some long rant of folks about how they're dealing with COVID or gripes about the management of it. For the organizations, I mean, is that subsuming some of the other initiatives, that some of the other priorities in terms of planning for both working with it right now, but also thinking about longer term, how much this needs to factor into what they plan to do operationally or how they plan to have their own forces better prepared and advanced for some potential follow-on diseases, like you said, which if these trends that you're identifying are correct and they're going in that direction, we may be off of a once in a century cycle with this kind of an event and be moving to a higher tempo and frequency of having to deal with this type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I want to reiterate again that, I mean, all of the consensus out there, whether it's risk analysis firms or, you know, national security reports, this is going to happen again, full stop. It's just a question of when and where it's going to be. We saw Ebola happen in Africa. But, you know, returning to NATO, the big theme from the 2020 forum, speaking to, you know, hearing from the NATO Secretary General, is that NATO is now looking to future-proof its security policies. And, you know, we didn't realize how good we had it during the Cold War when it was just a binary struggle of ideology and primarily a kinetic struggle. Now NATO, more than ever as an organization, is really having to redefine and reorient where do they want to put investments, where they want to train, the type of partners they want to have, and how they're going to leverage those partnerships long term. Africa is just one example about where they need to be more prepared, even internally on the continent. There's been much more of a push about greening their economies, limiting their carbon footprint, changing, having more sustainable and viable energy supply chains and supply chains in general, right? I mean, becoming self-sufficient. So as I cited that, NATO is sort of, they've taken the first steps on this. They've definitely identified climate change as a major threat to the alliance and to all of its partner nations. It's also this new position that they're taking in ideology. It's also economically the best way to go. Because statistically, as we've seen, we're always reacting to a deteriorating situation instead of reacting when we have the upper advantage. And the money that is spent on crisis management and crisis stability pales into comparison to what we should all be investing in preventative policies up front. So I think both the economic and strategic level is what NATO is also considering moving forward.
So the translation mechanism for what you're just describing and actually putting in place a set of mechanisms to deal with that would strike me to be the kind of the focus on increased resiliency, which you could kind of overlap with some of those preventative efforts. Any sense of, again, at the either the individual nation level, but or NATO as a whole, about how the resiliency agenda might be reinvigorated by what we've just been experiencing throughout this so far horrific 2020, and seeing a bunch of different areas where we've learned that some of the reserves of either medical supplies, access to supply chains, and those things that you were touched on are proving to be just as shaky as some of the people had warned about, but there wasn't actually enough impetus to act and improve those in meaningful ways.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the first thing is that resiliency itself as a concept is never ending. It's an ongoing process that needs to be, you know, reiterated all the time. So from my perspective, the resiliency is both first internally, you know, member states taking responsibility for themselves. One of the main trends I found in this research was the poor dietary habits, for instance. And as you can see with the very sad fatality numbers, both in the United States and the UK, a lot of the deaths that they had were could have been prevented, or they could have been managed a lot better with better eating habits. And I know it sounds crazy that I'm saying that, you know, people need to eat less Big Macs and eat more vegetables, but statistically, the evidence confirms this, that the fatalities in a lot of those countries were with bad dietary habits could have been avoided. And that's something, if we're serious about internal resiliency, we have to do. Supply chains is just one issue. We have to make sure that we're not going to go down this path of nationalization of the economy, that, you know, we're living in a globalized world and, you know, you can outsource everything yourself. So that's one issue. So once we've successfully gone through this internal process of resiliency, the next step, which makes sense, is to go externally to help countries with expertise, with resources who don't necessarily have it. Again, I was shocked at what a big deal it meant for countries not to have proper sanitary and access to clean water and all of the communicable diseases that come from it. And if anything has proven is that these diseases do not stay where they are. I mean, for instance, as a crazy example, in 2009 or 10, I believe, when Haiti had the massive earthquake, they had cholera that came back that was there for 9 years and killed almost 100,000 people. This was a disease that was eradicated. So pandemics have a way of reanimating diseases very quickly for things that we thought were dead. So it's in everybody's interest for Canada to be spending more money on these preventative policies, sharing their expertise, providing the most basic things like, you know, clean sleeping accommodation and clean water so that these diseases don't get a new lease on life.
And I guess to draw from that, amongst the other considerations now that we need to be thinking about in the West is that in a global context with a disease that is now spread globally, you know, there's been already been some discussion about how you manage the distribution of a vaccine or effective therapeutics that, that really become globally accessible. And I guess part of the kind of the nakedly parochial interest in doing that for defense organizations is that where we are right now, we may have sorted this out to varying degrees in our own country, but if you're deploying in the future into an area where COVID has just simply never been adequately dealt with and it's resident in that population, that would remain a force protection concern of a quite different type going forward. So that if you're sending troops on under a NATO rubric into Africa, as an example, and you're into a high COVID environment where you have the potential to bring it back home, you're going to have to keep all of these measures in place, maybe not the turnstiles and the facial recognition and temperature checks that you folks dealt with, but having to deal with it in a real and substantive way going forward.
No, I mean, I think it's very evident. I mean, just as an example, right, with the NATO training mission in Iraq, Iraq has been hit very hard with this. The one advantage that we have going into that situation is at this point, 6 months, a year from now, hopefully we'll have a vaccine or, you know, a couple of vaccine options that will prove useful. There'll be therapeutics. And more importantly, the strategy about which how we're engaging with this, I think will be very refined. But suffice to say, moving forward, whether it's the training mission in Iraq or EFP in Latvia or, you know, other missions, COVID will be along for a while. And obviously our immune system will develop a strength to it. But as I said, this is not going anywhere. And we're going to have to plan for this long term about also, you know, soldiers coming back from deployment and having to quarantine and how that first generation is going to be made up for back home, which goes back to my point about why I think sort of enlarging the military reserves and, you know, having this high level of readiness is never been more important for Canada and its allies.
And we're seeing that in many different scenarios, as we talked about. We've got examples of that in Canada domestically about getting into long-term care facilities, as well as helping other government agencies with distribution of medical supplies and those sorts of things. I guess as a last thing to touch on substantially before you get to what you're reading right now, in Slovakia, we're seeing an extensive use of the military involved in a mass testing program. Just touch on that briefly as the last example of what we might potentially see in the future before we turn to what is sitting on your bedside table.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a great source of pride in my sort of half-adopted home country now in Slovakia, where when the idea was first pitched by Prime Minister Matovic, it was sort of laughed at that. I mean, Slovakia is a country of 5.5 million. How on earth are we going to test all of these people? So finally, they came up with the strategy of anybody over the age, I think it was 18 until an adult, you would go for your voluntary test. And in a very organized manner, with a lot of logistics planning with the military, them running point on it, Operation Common Responsibility, they were able to test as of late this week, 3.7 million people using these rapid antigen tests. And I think the most important thing was, like, nobody thought this was, once the testing was over, this was going to return life to normal. This was just a preventative measure that was able to identify clusters. It was able to isolate people. And it was also the people who tested negative were able to receive a waiver, which allowed them more freedom to move around while Slovakia is on lockdown. And I think what made me most proud about it is that GlobeSec was actually part of the logistical process, having a little bit of experience organizing this for the forum and the Tatra summit. So 20 of my colleagues were working at it. And this ranged from data entry, filling out forms, you know, all of these people on the weekend showing up in hazmat suits. So I was super proud of GlobeSec for participating in it. And also it might be a viable opportunity for other countries moving down the line for Canada to even consider about, you know, the benefits of mass testing on this scale.
Okay. So now when you're looking for a change of pace and not necessarily dealing with these issues, what are you reading these days?
Well, you know, like a good Central and Eastern European, you need a little bit of comedy in the dark side. So at the moment, I'm reading Jaroslav Hasek's The Good Soldier Schweik, which is sort of the precursor to Catch 22. And it's just the story of a bumbling Czech soldier in the Austrian army in the First World War, and makes me feel right at home reading about the incompetency of our favorite Schweik character.
So Roger, thanks so much for joining us again today on Defense Deconstructed.
Thanks a lot, David, and look forward to the future podcast with everybody.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producer, Charlotte Duval-Antoine, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.